Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to chat with author David Hare. He's from New Zealand. He has a fantasy series, and he's very interesting and well-traveled. This is a recorded show, so please don't call in. There was a little bit of technical difficulty toward the middle, but the rest of it is terrific. Enjoy the show. Hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Sherry. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I'm very excited. I mean, award-winning and all that. Could you tell me a little bit about your background and how you came to be a writer?
Sure. I'm a New Zealander. I grew up in kind of rural New Zealand, although I've traveled a bit recently. I worked in financial services, but I always had the dream of being a writer. From a very young age, I remember stealing a notebook from my father with the intention that I was going to write a story about a fighter pilot. But I got about two sentences in and realized I knew nothing about jet fighters, and I stopped. So it's been a long-held dream, which I finally sort of got round to writing the book, and I guess I sent it off. It got rejected. I sulked for a while, and then I got persuaded to try again in what was retrospect a better set of publishers than the ones that I'd chosen at random from the phone book. And the first book got accepted, and it was lucky enough to get the best first novel at the New Zealand Children's Book Awards, and that then became a bit of a calling card for me, enabled me to secure other writing gigs, and I've now got 17 books published by the major publishers, and another 5 contracted at the moment. So I'm a full-time writer.
That's amazing. And what was the name of the award for, I know you said Best Children's Book, but what was the award, the name of it?
The name of the book or the name of the award?
The name of the award. You can give me the name of the book, too.
Sure. Well, the book is called... Sorry, there's some vehicles going past. I'm sitting on it, just to set the scene for your listeners. I'm sitting on a sunny balcony in rural New Zealand, overlooking a beautiful garden which belongs to my brother and sister-in-law. And it's where my wife and I have been camping for the last 6 months while she's been job hunting. The book was called The Bone Tiki. It's a young adult novel, and the award that it got was the New Zealand Children's and Young Persons Book Awards Best First Novel, and that was back in 2009.
That's really cool. And what you just described sounds idyllic.
I wish I could send you a photo. I should send you a photo, actually, but I won't try and do it now.
Yeah. Send me a photo, but not now. but yeah, I'd love to see it. It sounds beautiful. We were talking before the show, and I was saying my whole knowledge of your country is from watching where shots behind the scenes from Xena Warrior Princess was, but I do know different parts of the country from that show. It's huge.
Sure.
I mean, it's not a huge island, but you have so many different kind of climates. You have hot and cold and tropical and, like, bush, and I mean, is it interesting? I mean, if you drive one way, it's one kind of climate, and you drive another, it's another.
Oh, absolutely. New Zealand's a long, thin country, and with two major islands and then a few small ones. And you've got everything from mountains and Alps with snow on them to arid areas, which are technically a desert, although they're not sandy deserts, and they're certainly not Arizona-class deserts, to dense bush and beautiful lakes, beautiful rivers, farmland. Yeah, we've got a bit of everything here, which is, why, for example, the Lord of the Rings movies were able to all be filmed in New Zealand, but have such amazingly different landscapes on screen.
It's so beautiful from what I've never been there, but from all the pictures I've seen, it's just, that's one of my bucket list is Australia, New Zealand, that area someday. Maybe.
You can dock down in our spare room once we have one.
That would be nice. Thank you.
At the moment, we're in between houses. As I mentioned earlier, we've been here the last 6 months, but Terry's just, that's my wife, has just secured a new job in Wellington, which is the capital city. At the moment, we're living in outside of Whakatane, which is in rural Bay of Plenty. And so once we've finished talking, I'm jumping into a car for a 7-hour drive down to Wellington, and we're going to do some house hunting. So, it's a busy time for us. We're kind of in flux at the moment. We had been living in Bangkok in Thailand for the previous 2.5 years, but then Kerry's post came to an ending, and so did her employment with Immigration New Zealand, and so she had to go into the job market again.
Wow. That must have been culture shock coming back after 2 years in Bangkok.
I suppose, although Bangkok is it's a big modern metropolis. It's also a beautiful Asian city with a lot going on. But the culture shock, yeah, not so much. Kerry's previous overseas posting with me was to India. We lived in New Delhi in India for 4 years, and that was much bigger culture shock because the India, even Delhi, is nowhere near as modern as say Bangkok.
Judi Dench described it as a wall of sounds when she went for best exotic Marigold Hotel. Is that how you would describe it?
I would say that it's a wall. We usually say an assault on the senses because it's not just the sound. India has its own smell, it has its own, obviously its own set of tastes in terms of foods and drinks and stuff. And visually, there's so much colour. You know, people wear colours, whereas people are so conservative in the West in what they wear. It's normal there for people to be in bright oranges and yellows and reds and greens and stuff, whereas we all wear kind of greys and pale blues and dark blues and stuff in the West. So it's an assault on the senses, India, and it's an amazing place to live. Those 4 years were unforgettable.
I bet. Wow. That's exciting. But are you happy to be home?
Of course. We're back with back in our, where everything kind of, we're familiar. I'll be back in Wellington, which is where my two children are living and working, and where most of my best friends are. That's where I worked in financial services for 20 years prior to meeting Kerry and going to India. Being back on home turf is really nice.
That's cool. You write children's books, but do you expand? Do you do other things? What is your feeling about writing? And do you explore or do you stick to one thing?
First question, I guess, was do I just write children's books? No, I don't. I started off writing children's books because the Bone Tiki idea was my best current idea at the time that I had a break in my life where I could write. So that's the reason I started writing the Bone Tiki, and I guess I then sort of for a while, young adult fiction was what I did. I wrote another 5 sequels to the Bone Tiki, and then while I was living in India, I also wrote a 4-book YA series based in India and set around the Indian epic of the Ramayana. But my love and has always been fantasy and epic fantasy. I grew up with Lord of the Rings and with the book The Balgariad by David Eddings and Stephen Donaldson's Thomas Covenant books and stuff like that. So I always wanted to try my hand at writing proper adult epic fantasy. And so while I was working on my YA books, I also was working on putting together an epic fantasy series, and that got picked up by one of the major British publishers, and then it's been published into the into the US and been translated into German, Dutch, Bulgarian as well, Turkish as well, and made into an audio book by Audible in America. And that's the Moontide Quartet. And that's a sort of like an East meets West epic fantasy series set on a fantasy world. And so that's kind of my mainstay. That's the book which is my international calling card. The Bone Tiki is my domestic calling card, I guess. But the Moontide Quartet is my mainstay with international. And I've done a sequel series to that as well, which I'm halfway through writing at the moment.
What do you like to read? Do you have a favorite genre? Are you more of a fantasy guy, or do you like biographies? Or are you eclectic and you like a lot of different things?
Reasonably eclectic. I grew up reading a lot of fantasy. That was, you know, my mainstay through my teenage years. But I've also read thrillers, westerns even. There was a guy called J.T. Edson who did these pulp western things, which I got quite addicted to for a few years at one stage. Some biographies, and I'm a history major at university, so I do read history for pleasure and stuff like that. So, yeah, reasonably eclectic. The problem I have with reading is that since I've started writing, so over the last decade, I guess, reading is no longer, it feels like it's part of my job now instead of part of my relaxation. So when I've spent a day typing words onto a computer screen, the last thing I really want to look at is words on a page or a computer screen when I'm trying to relax. So my reading has dropped off quite significantly. And I no longer read in the genre that I'm writing, because I don't want other people's voices or ideas coming into what I do. So I tend to find that now that I'm writing fantasy, I tend to, when I'm reading, read things like histories and biographies and stuff like that, and often within a very analytical look, like I'm reading with a view that maybe I will see a story in this period, or maybe I can glean something from this that'll help me.
I understand that completely, but the funny thing about it is that if I like a book, or, well, not even a book, if I like a movie or a TV show that's based on a book, not only will I read the book, I want to know about the author, and I read all about the author. I get a little crazy about that. I'm not crazy like I'm want to meet the author. It's more like I want to read everything about the author. Like, for instance, Jane Austen. And this is when I was young. I think the first one I ever saw was the TV series Pride and Prejudice in the 80s.
Yes.
With Colin Firth.
Yes, Colin Firth, yeah, I remember. Everybody was swooning over Mr. Darcy at that stage, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was easy to swoon. He was easy to look at. Well, Jennifer Eale wasn't exactly hard to look at either, for the men. So yeah. It was an even thing. But I knew about Jane Austen, but I had never read her, so I said, oh, I gotta read Pride and Prejudice. So I read Pride and Prejudice, which was even better than the movie, I mean the TV miniseries, which is sort of normal. And then I just had, I read all of the books, all the letters, every autobiography I get my hands on. It's just this weird thing I have. It's like, my dad said I would have been a great researcher. He used to say that because I want to know everything about somebody or something.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's what I find a lot of time with the history. I've always been, from a young age, I was surrounded by sort of kids' versions of history and how the world, you know, became the world it is. And I would sort of pick periods, particularly, I guess, in Napoleonic Wars and even the American Civil War, I got very, very interested in at one stage, and would read up a lot about, you know, certain events and stuff. I think there was Michael Shara, I think, did this wonderful book about Gettysburg, and trying to remember what the book was called now. And then his son did a prequel and a sequel that covered the early part of the Civil War and then the latter part of the Civil War. And I just drank those down, and there was other books. I even bought biographies of some of the generals, like Longstreet and Lee and people like that. So I got quite fascinated with the military history of it. More, I guess, than the political history. I was a bit of a military history kid when I was growing up.
I understand. It's just that you get fascinated by stuff. And if you love history, which we both do, it's easy to get sucked in. Like, I love the 20s. I think that, there's bad parts of the 20s, but there's bad parts of every period. And I just find it fascinating because, really, people don't get it. Our whole modern age really started in the 20s. Women's rights, rights for workers, equality discussions for different minority groups. And this is not just in my country, it's all around the world. If you really look at the 20s in every part, it's fascinating. And so I get kind of obsessed about that too, because I think that era was pivotal, because there were so many, there was prohibition, and alcoholism was at a high, and there's a lot of bad stuff from the period too. And this is all before the stock market crashed. Very interesting. Do you find yourself
the 20s
like that?
A very colorful period in that sense. Although, of course, it had the roots to that were often, people coming back from the First World War,
mm-hmm.
and the extra burden I think that women had taken up while men were away, in terms of getting into the workplace instead of being stay at home. And I think it created a very powerful dynamic towards greater equality, greater democratization. It changed wealth patterns. So the First World War, I think, the 20s wouldn't have happened without the First World War.
Exactly.
Particularly, I guess, the forces changing Europe, obviously, but also the countries that went along. New Zealand's participation in the First World War was, by population, one of the highest in the world, because New Zealand had been largely settled from Britain. And our Prime Minister at the time said, where Britain goes, we go. And our young men and women went over to fight on the other side of the world, basically because of our ancestral roots.
And that's something that's really interesting when you read history, is that if you get interested in one period, you want to know how... Well, if you have an inquiring mind, you want to know how that started. So, actually, I didn't know very much about World War One until I started really reading about the 20s. And then I was like, oh, this came from this, and this, oh, I got to read. And so I started reading about World War One. And I also, I have to admit, I'm obsessed with certain shows that are set in the 20s. And every single character from... those shows that I've seen from when I was, I was young the first time I watched the show set in the 20s, which was Partners in Crime from Agatha Christie. That started because Agatha was talking about her first romance with Archie in World War One and how it all came about, and except the partnership between Tommy and Tuppence was a lot better than her marriage. But it was like, oh, okay, so that came from that. And her becoming so independent was because she was a nurse during the war. And, and then you start reading about it, because you have to read about the real history, at least I do, the real history in order to really understand the characters in the fiction that you're reading. At least
sure. That's
my way my mind works.
Yeah.
Did you feel that way when you were getting hooked into that period?
I've had two dabbles in First World War stuff. The first one was when I was a kid, and there was a British fighter pilot who became an author called W.E. Johns, and he wrote a character called Biggles.
I've heard that.
And he was a fighter ace. But he was one of those ageless James Bond type characters who got to be a fighter ace in both the Second World War and the First World War.
He really had a life. Wow.
I think he found the fountain of youth at some stage during the Battle of the Somme and never aged after. But I loved those fighter pilot books, and you know, the old biplanes and sort of the Knights of the Air vibe of it. And that was my first big fascination with the First World War. Second one is much, much more recent. I got approached by Scholastic New Zealand, who are a children's and young persons publisher who deals specifically with you know, the schools market mostly. And they had a concept that they were going to invite five New Zealand YA writers to each contribute a book about a specific topic of a specific year of the First World War, as part of the commemorations for the First World War centenary here in New Zealand. And I was approached as one of those, and I was assigned the 1916 book. So this is my only work that's a non-fantasy. Everything else I've written is basically a fantasy novel. This is a historical book, but I had license to create characters as long as the broad sweep of the story and the incidents, you know, the primary incidents were real. So I did a lot of research into it. They wanted me to work on the New Zealand Maori Battalion, I guess on the strength that Bone Tiki had quite strong Maori content. And so I ended up writing a book set around two young characters, a white boy and a Maori boy, who enlist underage into this battalion, which is formed 50% initially Maori and 50% men from the deep south of New Zealand around Otago, who were of Scottish descent. And there was a lot of internal friction in the battalion before they all basically became brothers in arms. And they fought in Belgium and in at the big Battle of the Somme during 1916, which was my allotted year. So I had a lot of fun pulling that story together. I wanted it to be an adventure story, but I wanted it to weave together real events. And I had a lot of fun poring over the history of that unit and picking out different things. And I was able to weave a spy story, which our young protagonist sold, in and about the real battle scenes of the First World War. So that was my more recent encounter with the First World War.
That is really cool, though. That sounds fascinating.
I've always put a lot of history into my books. The Bone Tiki, as I mentioned, is set in New Zealand, and it's got a lot of Maori mythology content, but it's also got a lot of history content as well. I was working on a concept that the land remembers things that have happened and that it holds on to them. And so the concept was that parallel to our world, there's a parallel world where everything that people know have happened but also believe might have happened is there. So if you step through the gateways between our world and that world, you get to meet people from history who the land preserves for you, and you get to meet creatures from the mythology who are also there. So I wove a story about an evil sorcerer who was hunting for something this boy inadvertently had found. But while he goes on this journey to escape the sorcerer and to fulfill what's needed to defeat the sorcerer, and in doing so he meets famous people from New Zealand history, and he gets to encounter creatures from New Zealand and Maori mythology and stuff. So history as well as mythology has also played a big part in the sort of things that I write.
I think it's fascinating. I always find history to be compelling. One of my favorite things is I studied archaeology, so I find books that encompass archaeology and thrillers and a mystery, I eat it up. I think that one of the reasons why is you have at least I think most people have a desire to know why. Where does it come from? Why are we like this? Do you think that is one of the reasons you followed the path of the writer?
I agree with you about the inquiring mind, although I don't agree necessarily that most people have that. I think that if you look around, I think that a lot of people don't question what's around them and accept what authority figures and influences tell them without question. And I think in our current era, we're sort of bombarded with so much information that we can't take it all in, and no one's checking the facts that an inquiring mind is more important than ever.
Yeah, you're right.
But we're not going to talk about this year's election.
No, I'm actually kind of over the whole thing. I voted, I did my patriotic duty, I asked other people to do theirs. I'm done.
Yeah, fair enough. But I agree that when you do have an inquiring mind, and I think an inquiring mind is something which is important for people to cultivate, then you do start to look behind the story and behind the reasons, and you start to see other people's perspectives and points of view as well, and understand them better. And I think travel plays a huge part into that as well. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity in my life to live in England and in India and in Thailand, and to travel fairly extensively to other countries through Asia. I've been into Russia. I've been to America a couple of times. There's obviously a lot of other places I'm very, very keen to go. I think travel and an inquiring mind are important parts of being a...
Okay, we had a little technical problem, but we're back. You were talking about travel and how it influenced you.
Yeah, I think living and seeing how other people live and the things that move their lives, I think are an important part of being a global citizen, really, of understanding differences and overcoming them. I think if we stay in our row and don't look at what other people are doing and how other people live, we can become very insular and unable to compromise. And I think the world needs compromise at the moment. The world needs to find a way forward without resorting to conflict. And I think the more you understand the other side and the more you can empathize with other people's issues, I think the better we're all able to get on. And I think history has and travel have an important part to play in that. History, what do they say? That people who don't understand and know their history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
And I think we're always in danger of doing that.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think the big important parts of our lives is our history. And I can remember, I probably bored my children. I would sit them down occasionally. I would just say, do you guys know anything about the First World War or the Second World War or how we got to be where we are? And I would sort of talk to them for 10 or 20 minutes, and then their eyes would glaze over. But I would later find out that some of it would actually stick, and that they did develop something of an interest at times.
I think that's something very important about parenting. My dad was like that. My mom and dad were like that. Different subjects, but they used to, like, go, they, you know, especially if they were enthused, they would go off and start talking about it. And maybe we did at the time glaze over just teensy tiny little bit, but we both picked it up because we're both history nuts. We both astronomy and archaeology and all that stuff. And our parents also, I have been moving. I have never, until I was an adult, I never lived anywhere for more than 3 years my whole life, until I was in my 30s. So yep. I was always traveling. I learned a lot about the world. about my country, and also we traveled outside the country. And I think when you're young and you get that kind of input from your parents, like you said, you learn history and you learn about the world and you learn about other cultures. That is something so important, and we need more of that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it requires a bit of wealth to be able to travel and stuff, but I mean, I think from a New Zealand perspective and experience, we're a very, very small country, and we tend to get a lot of our cultural inputs from other parts of the world, from, you know, the old mother country of England, but also from America and from Australia and places. And it means when we grow up watching dramas and documentaries from other parts of the world, it does implant a desire in you to see them. But it also, because we know that we're a small country and that our fate is, you know, to some extent depends upon the fate of the world, we watch the rest of the world very avidly. I think if I compare times when I've lived in other countries, the domestic content of the news always outweighs the international by a huge degree. You know, you'll get the local news, and then you'll get your own country's news. And then if you're lucky, you might get a snippet of something interesting or bizarre that's happened overseas, and that's it. In New Zealand, the overseas content that we get in our news is a large part of the news hour. And so I think we develop more of a hunger to see the world, perhaps, than other countries. And so we have quite a large diaspora of people who go off and live or just travel. And what we call the OE, the overseas experience, is very much a part of the New Zealand culture growing up, where at sort of age 19 or 20, you grab a backpack and you fossick around to, you know, working to get some money, and then you go and travel overseas for a year or two, just living cheap and seeing the world, and then maybe you settle overseas or maybe you come back home, but, you know, you've definitely had your horizons changed and you've got that international outlook. And I think that's definitely part of the New Zealand character.
I think that's interesting. Well, first, I just want to clarify, we weren't rich. My daddy got transferred a lot.
Sure, yeah.
Just letting you know. I didn't buy a car, which was unusual because I was a kid in California, but I wanted to travel. And I knew that if I bought a car when I was a teenager, I would not be able to do that. So,
you're smart. Money's a car trip.
Yeah.
Car's a money trip.
Yeah. And I was like, it wasn't even really that thought out. It was more like, well, if I spend my salary on registration and insurance and the car payment, I'll not be able to go to Mexico, to Europe, to other places that I want to go to. So that was my thinking. It wasn't really that deep. It was more like balance.
Yeah. But that's how a lot of the time we make our decisions at that age. So that's entirely explicable. I remember when I went overseas, stopped education, I worked for a couple of years to get a bit of money together, and then basically I blew most of that money on an air ticket to join my English friend, because he wanted to go back to England to see his roots, because he had come over to New Zealand as a 6-year-old. So he and I first went to Australia and picked grapes to get the money, because we had enough money to get to Australia and a little bit more. But we didn't have enough money to do everything we wanted to do in Europe. So we went to Australia and picked grapes to earn the money to get to Europe, and then to have a 2 or 3 months traveling on rail passes around the continent. And then we both got jobs in England. And I stayed for another year in England, and then sort of indulging my passion for football and historical places and that. He got a full-time job with the RAF catering section and stayed for another 5 years, I think, in England before he came back home.
Wow.
It's all about what you can afford and where you've got contacts and stuff, rather than some broad philosophical view of life, I guess, at that age.
Yeah, I mean, I was I was a teenager, so I wasn't like,
yeah.
Oh, I'm going to do this because I want to see the, I want to make sure. No, no, it was more like, I want to go to this place, and I can't afford it if I have a car. So.
Yeah. Got it.
And I was also saving my money to go to college, too, so it was like, there was a lot of different factors that. But it's interesting, you were saying that, that's something my dad always said, if you do not understand and accept what history happened, history is doomed to repeat, or something like, I can't remember the exact quote. But one of the things that I find kind of sad is that people think history is boring. If history is just facts and figures and you're not looking at the people and what is happening to people, yeah, I guess it could be boring. But if you look at history as all these people living their lives and being affected by what's happening, then it's not boring. It's fascinating. It's really how it's taught.
Yes, absolutely. And you're definitely preaching to the converted, because I agree with you 100% on that. But history, I always found fascinating. But it's when you put your, you try and envisage yourself living through those times, and how would you deal with it? You know, I remember one of the papers we did that was the rise of Nazi Germany,
mm-hmm.
and of course Hitler was elected. He didn't seize power in a coup initially. He was elected to power, and then he clamped down on the democratic process so that he could stay in power. You looked at the forces that were moving people at the times, you know, in a country which had been defeated in the First World War and was desperate to get back on its feet and was seizing on to this demagogue who promised them everything. And you look at that and you go, well, you know, how would I have voted back then? And, you know, I came from a what I would say is a conservative religious family. That's how I grew up. Not necessarily how I am now, but those were the people who elected Hitler in Germany, were those, that group of people, basically, the people who wanted to see Germany's glories restored, who and Hitler seemed to say the things that they thought, you know, that they thought and believed in, and then he turned out to be a monster, and it's scary, and those are the stories from history that you need to know, but you do need somebody who makes it exciting for you. And I was very lucky at Boys High and then again at Victoria University. The history teachers were passionate people who taught and lectured with passion and made it fascinating for me.
Yeah, I agree. My brother and I shared one teacher that we both really liked. It was our history teacher when we were in junior high school. His name was Mr. Pecor. He was amazing. He was kind of scary to some of the students because he didn't suffer fools. But
yeah.
You kind of know who's all bark and no bite just by just watching them. And I knew he was sweetie as long as you did your work.
He sounds a lot like my history teacher at Naked Boys. Is a guy called Philip Rankin. And he had a reputation, same sort of thing, as being a hard, scary guy. But he had such a droll sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, you know, he was just strict. He expected you to do the work, but he was brilliant to be taught by.
Yeah, and it was so much fun. He would like American history. It was, I think it was seventh grade, so it was my first year, and he was so much fun because he would talk about it in a way that you were there with Benjamin Franklin when he was addressing the French court and demanding help to, and yet being diplomatic at the same time. And he was really, he was so engaging, and I think between my dad and Mr. Pecor, my brother and I just both were hooked, and from then on, history was open to us.
Yeah.
And we need teachers like that. We need people who make you feel like you are part of it. we're all part of it. We're all part of the human experience, so we are part of history.
And part of that, I think, also, I mean, it's something that's a big debate in New Zealand at the moment, because there's been a teacher strike recently, and it's about teachers being valued.
Exactly.
And being paid what they contribute to, you know, for what they contribute to society, instead of being treated as just one process in a meat market of talent identification, you know, which is what education in a capitalist society can become. So that's that whole thing about rewarding teachers and enabling them, freeing them from paperwork to be able to do what they do best and are passionate about is a big debate in New Zealand at the moment.
And I think it's so important because it changes all the time. I mean, I remember there was a period where there was a huge thing to appreciate teachers, and then it kind of waned, and then it came back, and now they have the National Teacher Award, but sort of waning again. It's just this weird ocean kind of thing. But you should just appreciate the teachers who are great, who help you, that inspire your children or inspire you. You should appreciate them. It should be second nature.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of that comes back to the commercialization of education and the way that that education has gradually over the last few decades has been turned from something which governments provided for free to something that people now have to pay for. You have to pay for your education at in not just the university levels, but increasingly at more basic levels as well. And that dilutes the whole purpose of education and makes it hands it back to the elite. Where education, you know, started off as something only the elite got and could afford, and then it became democratized over the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, and we've seen capitalist forces sort of reclaim education for the elite as part of a money making operation, which I think is it does our society no favor at all.
No, it doesn't. We are coming to the end. I want to give you enough time. Can you tell us a little bit, not giving away anything, but can you tell us a little bit about your new book?
Sure. I've got a new project coming up, and it's the first time I've ever collaborated with another writer. A couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, 4 years ago maybe, I shared a writer's event with a lady called Catherine Mayo, and it turned out we both had quite an interest in Greek mythology and history. My history degree was also partly a classical studies degree, and so I knew my basics on Greek history, and I'd always thought that would be an interesting mythology to set a book in. As it turned out, Kat had already written a couple of teenage novels about a teenage Odysseus being the hero of the Trojan War, who comes up with the idea of the Trojan horse and then is the subject of the Odyssey, which is his journey back and all of the trials and tribulations of that. And so we got our heads together and we thought, well, let's work together on something and let's come up with a kind of a fantasy version of Odysseus as a prequel, in a prequel setting to the Trojan War. So we've got a deal of three books, which we're hoping we can expand to more, which are basically Odysseus's adventures prior to the Trojan War, and how he gains his reputation as the craftiest and cleverest of the Greek heroes. So that's available only at ebook at this stage through Canalo's UK, as well as print on demand. And I think it's some of the best stuff I've ever done. And I think because I wanted to prove to Kath, I guess, that I was worthy of working with her, and I think she probably felt the same. So we both brought our very A game to the table. And we also had a lot of fun with the character and the mythology of coming up with a way in which the gods and the mythology and the actual history and archaeology that we know about the ancient Greece period could all be brought together into one coherent story that told how the Trojan War came to be. So it's a project we're both really passionate about. It's also the first story I've written as a first person, so we're entirely inside Odysseus' head the whole time, and that's been a lot of fun, because he's a clever, witty hero. Who, you know, he's, so we've given him that sort of one-liner sensibility and a sense of dash and elan about everything he does. So we've had a lot of fun with it. I think it's just a really fun, readable project, and Kath has been a delight to work with.
That is cool, because that will bring that whole amazing tablet that the two stories of the Trojan War, going to war and then leaving the war, and the hard journey back, and how he had a fight to get his wife and his country back and all that. Are you going to be covering all that?
Well, it, a lot depends on commercial factors. But if the series does well, we've certainly storyboarded ourselves all of the way to the start of the Trojan War. This, the initial three books, takes us halfway there. And then we have, we've spent a lot of time on world building, how the gods work and how the magic works and how the story works in our story world. And it does provide a unique take that we could then apply to the Trojan War and the Odyssey, that tells the story while sticking to the Homer canon of how these things played out. It could retell it in an entirely different light, because we've focused a lot more than any other writers, I believe, on the real history and the known stuff that, from that period, as well as weaving in certain myths that other people have never connected to it. So I think we've done something unique, and I would love to take it all the way to the end of the Odyssey.
That's cool. That's a series I'd like to read. Sounds really fascinating.
Sure.
Do you have a website, and do you have any social media where people can contact you to say hi?
Yes, I do. I have an author Facebook page. I have a Twitter account, which is dhairauthor, so at dhairauthor, and I have a website, which is www.davidhairauthor.com, so davidhairauthor, that's hair, H-A-I-R, and so I have a presence. I'm not a terribly diligent social media person, so I'm not going to be filling up your inbox with pictures of cats or whatever. I do occasionally tweet, usually something to do with one of my books coming out. I tend to just stick to my bread and butter in terms of my presence.
That's sort of like me on Twitter. I go there, I promote, I leave. I'm not huge. I don't like some of the ugliness on Twitter, so I stay away from it.
I think for me, it just never occurs to me to do it until everybody says, why didn't you tweet that? And I'm like, just didn't even think of it. I think I just kind of grew up in the pre-Twitter generation, and it just doesn't enter my thought processes.
Yeah, I understand. I'm an older person, so social media is something that is a tool.
I think I'm an older person, too.
I want to thank you for coming on my show. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and I've really enjoyed talking to you, Sherry. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Me too. Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.